Hello, everybody. My name is Dick, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Mary. I'm an alcoholic.
Welcome to session number 4. We are going to cover steps 2 and 3 in this session. We left off on page 44, chapter 4, We Agnostics. So we'll do some reading. Let's start with the set-aside prayer.
God, please
let me set aside everything I think I know about sobriety, life, and you, so that I may be open to a new experience.
Amen. Chapter 4, We Agnostics. Remember we gave you the definition of agnostics. It's essentially somebody who really doesn't know if there is a God or is not a God. In the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic.
But just in case we've forgotten, they're going to review it in a sentence here.
If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if, when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic.
We have a two-part single question. We don't have 20 questions or 40. We just have a very simple two-part one question. Can you quit entirely? If that's not the case, when you start drinking, do you have little control over the amount you take? That means you're alcoholic.
If that be the case, meaning you've answered positively to the question, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer.
So that's step 2. That's the premise for step 2.
To one who feels he is an atheist or agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he is an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And again, atheist is a person who absolutely will tell you there is no God underlying the totality of everything. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. But it isn't so difficult. About half our original fellowship were of exactly that type.
So about half of the authors of this birth book were either atheists or agnostics.
At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue. Hoping against hope, we were not true alcoholics. And again, the half would be 50 people out of the first 100 men and women who wrote this book. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else.
Those sound like pretty hard words. Fact, must.
Perhaps it's going to be that way with you, but cheer up. Something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics. Our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted, meaning upset or disturbed. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral, we could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly.
They didn't just fail, they failed utterly.
And that means all the time. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. That's step 1. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves.
So let's look at that sentence that Mary just read. It had to be a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, plural. So it has to be a power greater than a group of human beings. Now, is the AA group a good place to start? Sure. But we want to work to a place where it's something other than a group of human beings, because a group of human beings can fail. It is not invincible. It is not omnipotent. So we're looking for a power, working toward a power that is greater than ourselves.
So when you hear people tell you that their higher power is a doorknob, I have to question whether or not that doorknob has power over a group of human beings.
I can turn a doorknob. I can open a door.
And Mother Nature actually is another good place to start.
Yeah. It's a place a lot of agnostics begin, because it's something greater than us. If you don't think Mother Nature is more powerful than a group of human beings, just try to stop a tornado or a hurricane.
The next sentence is the shortest sentence in the book. Obviously. Obviously what? The sentence before, we had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Obviously, but where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem.
So we're not just looking for any old higher power. What we're looking for is a higher power that will solve our problem. So if you're a person of faith and you're sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you're an alcoholic, maybe you just need to find a different way to tap into that power that you haven't been able to do. We're not suggesting that you have a different faith or you develop a different God or whatever. We're suggesting that maybe you take these tools that enable you to tap into the power that you've believed in. So we're looking for a power greater than ourselves, which will solve our problem. Now on page 85, mere 40 pages from now, they tell us once we've taken these steps, the problem has been removed. So in 40 short pages, we're given the tools to tap into a power that will solve our problem.
So again, this book is not about how to stop drinking.
Yeah.
It's how to tap into that power greater than ourselves. And the most important thing for me was that it doesn't say that the power which will help you to solve your problem. I was the problem. That means we have written a book about which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral. And it means, of course, that we're going to talk about God. Here, difficulty rises with agnostics. Many times we talk to a new man and watch his hope rise as we discuss his alcohol problems and explain our fellowship. But his face falls when we speak of spiritual matters, especially when we mention God. For we have reopened a subject which our man thought he had neatly evaded or entirely ignored. We know how he feels. We have shared his honest doubt and prejudice.
So those doubts and prejudices that we've had, people like me have had, about this whole subject of God are not dishonest. We're not being untrue to something. These are honest doubts and prejudices, so we're going to need to look at them.
And prejudices are old ideas.
Right.
Some of us have been violently anti-religious. To others, the word God brought up a particular idea of him with which someone had tried to impress them during childhood. Perhaps we rejected this particular conception because it seemed inadequate. With that rejection, we imagine we had abandoned the God idea entirely. So essentially they're saying, if somebody is trying to impose their concept of God on you and you reject that, it doesn't mean that you've actually abandoned the whole idea of God, though you might imagine you have. We were bothered with the thought that faith and dependence upon a power beyond ourselves was somewhat weak, even cowardly. We looked upon this world of warring individuals, warring theological systems, and inexplicable calamity with deep skepticism. We looked askance or with disapproval or distrust at many individuals who claimed to be godly. How could a supreme being have anything to do with it all? And who could comprehend a supreme being anyhow? Yet, in other moments, we found ourselves thinking, when enchanted by a starlit night, who then made all this? There was a feeling of awe and wonder, but it was fleeting and soon lost. Yes, we of agnostic temperament have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God.
So that's testimony on the part of the first 100. We don't need to believe in any kind of a power greater than ourselves. We only need to be willing to set aside our prejudices, our old ideas, and just open ourselves up to the possibility that there might be some sort of a power in the universe bigger than us.
So that willingness is a baby step toward that eventual belief. Much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Remember when Bill and Ebby were together, and Ebby finally said to Bill, "Okay, Bill, why don't you just choose your own concept of God?" Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps.
So we need more work, and look at the synonyms for God there: creative intelligence, spirit of the universe.
We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men.
When, therefore, we speak to you of God, we mean your own concept of God.
Or conception.
Yeah, thank you. So, this is a textbook. Once they teach you something, they're not going to re-teach it. So from now on, they're going to assume you understand that when the word God is used in this book, they mean whatever you believe that to be. They're not going to go back and say that every time like they do and how it works. They say, as you understood it, we're done with that. It means whatever you believe God to be, whatever you think that higher power is. This applies, too, to other spiritual expressions you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. So what I do with a lot of men when I work one-on-one with people is I will ask them if they are the kind of person like I was when I came in, that I had all kinds of prejudices against all kinds of spiritual terms, to write them on a yellow tablet and then bring them to our meeting when we get together, and we'll take them out and say, what are those prejudices that you have? What are those old ideas? Why does it bother you to use this term or that term? We get it out, we examine it, we play with it, and it takes the power away. At the start, back to the book, at the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth, to affect our first conscious relation with God as we understood him. Afterward, we found ourselves accepting many things which then seemed entirely out of reach. That was growth. But if we wished to grow, we had to begin somewhere. So we used our own conception of a higher power, however limited that was. So, we're going to ask ourselves the step two question. Here's the instructions for step two. We need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? So, they say, as soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he's on his way. So I ask that question. I'll ask you, the listener, that question. Do you believe that there is a power greater than yourself? If the answer to that is anything other than yes, it's a no answer. Maybe, I think so, I'm not sure. All of those are no answers. We need to back up, and we need to go to a simpler place. And the simpler place is, are you willing to believe that there is a power greater than yourself? If the answer to that is anything other than yes, we cannot go forward. Everything will build on step two. Step three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, and all of the steps are going to build on our willingness to believe that there's something in the universe just a teensy bit more powerful than me. And so if you can't answer that question in the affirmative, we'll go back to the beginning of the session, go to tape one or session one, and start over, because we need to build on that. So as soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him he's on his way.
Emphatically just means with very forceful speech.
It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. The asterisk says, please be sure to read Appendix 2 in Spiritual Experiences. We won't read that here. You might want to review it. It's okay. Go back and reread that in the back of the book on page 567.
And the reason we're not reading it again is we read it when we read page 25. So if you want to go back to that tape,
yep,
that would help. What about Cornerstone? Did you want to talk
sure
about the...
Yeah. In the days that the book was written, in the 1930s, buildings were largely built without concrete blocks, the way we build a home today. They were built with field stone. And they take stone from fields, or they'd quarry some rock, and they would cut it. And the cornerstone was at the corner of the building. If it was improperly cut, the stonemason would, the whole house would be sort of what my father used to say, kittywampus. It would be out of square. And a house that's out of square doesn't stand for very long. So it's the cornerstone is one of the most important stones that the stonemason cuts in order to make a building. So that's what they're referring to. This is a simple cornerstone. If it's properly done, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. That was great news for us, for we had assumed we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith, which seem difficult to believe. Now, we're going to go into a little dissertation here on the difference between faith and belief. I'm going to give you a shortcut, a 21st century sort of shortcut to understand the difference between faith and belief. If I had been blind all my life, and suddenly medical science gives me a cornea transplant, and I've got a new cornea, and I can see all of a sudden. And Mary says to me, Dick, the sun rises in the east every single morning, and it sets in the west every single night. I know her to be an honest person, so I will believe what she's telling me. I will believe that the sun is going to come up tomorrow, the sun comes up in the east and sets in the west. But until I watch it happen day after week after month after year, then and only then will I have the faith that it's going to become, that it's going to do that tomorrow morning. So faith is belief coupled with experience. And on the subject of alcoholism, I have no experience. So I need to just simply believe that there is a recovery from alcoholism. I need to believe that maybe these 12 steps might work. I don't have to have a solid belief. I just need to be willing to believe. When people presented us with spiritual approaches, how frequently they say, I wish I had what that man has. I'm sure it would work if I could only believe as he believes, but I cannot accept as surely true the many articles of faith which are so plain to him. So it's comforting to learn that we can commence at we can begin at a simpler level.
And that is the level of belief, willing to believe.
Besides a seeming inability to accept much on faith, we often found ourselves handicapped by obstinacy.
Obstinacy is just when you adhere to an opinion in spite of reason.
Sensitiveness and unreasoning prejudice, unreasoning old ideas. Many of us have been so touchy that even casual reference to spiritual things made us bristle with antagonism.
And that just means we're actively expressing our opposition to something.
This sort of thinking had to be abandoned. There's another one of those must words. Though some of us resisted, that'd be me, we found no great difficulty in casting aside such feelings. Faced with alcoholic destruction, we soon became as open-minded on spiritual matters as we had tried to be on other questions. In this respect, alcohol was the great persuader. It finally beat us into a state of reasonableness. Sometimes this was a tedious or tiresome process. We hope no one else will be prejudiced for as long as some of us were. The reader may still ask why he should believe in a power greater than himself. We think they're good reasons. Let us have a look at some of them.
The practical individual of today is a stickler for facts and results. Nevertheless, the 20th century readily accepts theories of all kinds, provided they are firmly grounded in fact. We have numerous theories, for example, about electricity. Everybody believes them without a murmur of doubt. Why this ready acceptance? Simply because it is impossible to explain what we see, feel, direct, and use without a reasonable assumption as a starting point. And that reasonable assumption is that we believe. Everybody nowadays believes in scores of assumptions for which there is good evidence but no perfect visual proof. And does not science demonstrate that visual proof is the weakest proof? It is being constantly revealed as mankind studies the material world that outward appearances are not inward reality at all. To illustrate, the prosaic or commonplace steel girder is a mass of electrons whirling around each other at incredible speed. These tiny bodies are governed by precise laws, and these laws hold true throughout the material world. Science tells us so. We have no reason to doubt it. When, however, the perfectly logical assumption is suggested, that underneath the material world and life as we see it, there is an all-powerful, guiding, creative intelligence, right there a perverse or contrarian, obstinate streak comes to the surface, and we laboriously set out to convince ourselves it isn't so.
All-powerful, guiding, creative intelligence are all synonyms for God.
We read wordy books and indulge in windy arguments.
Usually sitting on the bar stool.
Thinking we believe that this universe needs no God to explain it. Were our contentions true, it would follow that life originated out of nothing, means nothing, and proceeds nowhere. Instead of regarding ourselves as intelligent agents, spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation, we agnostics and atheists chose to believe that our human intelligence was the last word, the Alpha and the Omega.
Alpha is the first word in the Greek language, and Omega is the, excuse me, not word, Alpha is the first letter in the Greek alphabet, and Omega is the last letter in the Greek alphabet.
So we chose to believe that our human intelligence was the last word, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end of all. Rather vain of us, wasn't it? We who have traveled this dubious or questionable path beg of you to lay aside prejudice, even against organized religion.
And that would be me begging you, because I was one of those that had prejudices against organized religion. So I will beg you to lay aside those prejudices and look at the facts.
We have learned that whatever the human frailties of various faiths may be, those faiths have given purpose and direction to millions. People of faith have a logical idea of what life is all about. Actually, we used to have no reasonable conception whatever. We used to amuse ourselves by cynically dissecting spiritual beliefs and practices, when we might have observed that many spiritually minded persons of all races, colors, and creeds were demonstrating a degree of stability, happiness, and usefulness which we should have sought ourselves.
There's that races, colors, and creeds, which was light years ahead of where society was at in 1939.
Instead, we looked at the human defects of these people and sometimes used their shortcomings as a basis of wholesale condemnation. We talked of intolerance while we were intolerant ourselves. We missed the reality and the beauty of the forest because we were diverted by the ugliness of some of its trees. We never gave the spiritual side of life a fair hearing. In our personal stories, in the back of the book and peppered throughout the text material in the first 164 pages, you will find a wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than himself. Whether we agree with a particular approach or conception seems to make little difference. Experience,
that's their experience,
not what they thought, but experience and the actions they've taken, has taught us that these are matters about which, for our purpose, we need not be worried. They are questions for each individual to settle for himself. On one proposition, however, these men and women are strikingly agreed. Every one of them has gained access to and believes in a power greater than himself. This power has in each case accomplished the miraculous, the humanly impossible. As a celebrated American statesman put it, let's look at the record.
That celebrated American statesman was a man by the name of Al Smith, who had been governor of New York and was candidate for president of the United States in 1924.
So remember, what we're trying to do is establish a relationship with a higher power, and they're giving us testimony that every one of the first 100 has been able to do that, even the atheists and agnostics. Mm-hmm. Here's the celebrated American statesman putting it. Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power, and to do certain simple things, there has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements.
Look what they are calling the steps, requirements.
Once confused and baffled by the seeming futility of existence, they show the underlying reasons why they were making heavy going of life. Leaving aside the drink question, they tell why living was so unsatisfactory.
So this is another one of those paradigm shifts in the book. They're going to shift now. We're going to not be talking about alcoholism. We're going to be talking about living. So the rest of the book now will be talking about how we were unsatisfactory in our living experience.
When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith.
This world of ours has made more material progress in the last century than all the millenniums which went before. Almost everyone knows the reason. Students of ancient history tell us that the intellect of men in those days was equal to the best of today. Yet in ancient times, material progress was painfully slow. The spirit of modern scientific inquiry, research, and invention was almost unknown. In the realm of the material, men's minds were fettered by
hampered
by superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. Some of the contemporaries of Columbus thought a round earth preposterous. Others came near putting Galileo to death for his astronomical heritage. heresy, excuse me. So Columbus had a huge amount of difficulty finding somebody to finance his trip to sail west to get to the East Indies, East India. And because everybody said you're going to fall off the earth. You're going to sail until you just fall off the earth. And Galileo had the audacity to say that the sun was the center of the earth when the church at the time said, no, the earth is the center of the universe. Everything revolves around it. And he was unyielding in that, and they talked about maybe putting him to death for his heresies. That's where you disagree with the church. Mm-hmm. They didn't do that, of course. We asked ourselves this. Are not some of us just as biased and unreasonable about the realm of the spirit as were the ancients about the realm of the material? Even in the present century, American newspapers are afraid to print an account of the Wright brothers' first successful flight at Kitty Hawk. Had not all efforts at flight failed before? Did not Professor Langley's flying machine go to the bottom of the Potomac River? Was it not true that the best mathematical minds proved that man could never fly? So what they're referring there was, again, modern history in their time. It was a recent history. Professor Langley was a professor of mathematics. He had flown the first unmanned flying machine, and he tried to make one that would carry a person, that a person could fly in. And if you've ever seen the old newsreels where you have that three-winged airplane that goes down, it looks like off a ski jump or something, and falls into the water, that's Professor Langley's flying machine going into the Potomac River. The Potomac River is in Washington, D.C. And so he set about then, when he couldn't fly, to prove that man could never fly. It only could do unmanned flight. Back to the book. Had not people said that God had reserved this privilege to the birds? Only 30 years later, the conquest of air was almost an old story, and airplane travel was in full swing. But in most fields, our generation has witnessed complete liberation of our thinking. Show any longshoreman. A longshoreman is a person who loads and unloads ships, and in the 30s that was done manually. Show any longshoreman a Sunday supplement describing a proposal to explore the moon by means of a rocket. He'll say, I bet they do it, and maybe not so long either. This book was written in 1939. In 1969, Americans stepped on the surface of the moon. 30 years. Is not our age characterized by the ease with which we discard old ideas for new, by the complete readiness with which we throw away the theory or gadget that doesn't work for something new which does? We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. These are what I call the anti-promises. We're having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments?
That's a state of being just bewilderingly confused.
The basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was.
So when I'm working with somebody, I ask them, do you have any of these problems? And that's a good chance to talk about where they are in their life right now.
When we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. The Wright brothers' almost childish faith that they could build a machine which would fly was the mainspring of their accomplishment. Without that, nothing could have happened. We agnostics and atheists were sticking to the idea that self-sufficiency would solve our problems. When others showed us that God's sufficiency worked for them, we began to feel like those who had insisted that the Wrights would never fly. Logic is great stuff. We like it. We still like it. It's not by chance that we're given the power to reason, to examine the evidence of our senses, and to draw conclusions. That's one of man's magnificent attributes. We agnostically inclined would not feel satisfied with a proposal which does not lend itself to a reasonable approach and interpretation. Hence or so, we're at pains to tell why we think our present faith is reasonable, why we think it's more sane and logical to believe than not to believe, why we say our former thinking was soft and mushy when we threw up our hands in doubt and said, we don't know. That's an agnostic saying that.
When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis we could not postpone or evade, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be?
Decision time. What is your choice to be? It's now we're going to be making a decision.
Arrived at this point, we were squarely confronted with a question of faith. We couldn't duck the issue. Some of us had already walked far over the bridge of reason.
Bridge of reason is capitalized.
Toward the desired shore of faith. The outlines and the promise of the new land had brought luster or brightness to tired eyes and fresh courage to flagging spirits. Friendly hands had stretched out in welcome. We were grateful that reason had brought us so far, but somehow we couldn't quite step ashore. Perhaps we had been leaning too heavily on reason that last mile, and we did not like to lose our support.
So the reason is all capitalized. What the inference is that we were using reason as our higher power. So we were using our ability to reason, to think, as our higher power.
That was natural, but let us think a little more closely. Without knowing it, had we not been brought to where we stood by a certain kind of faith? For did we not believe in our own reasoning? Did we not have confidence in our ability to think? What was that but a sort of faith? Yes, we had been faithful, abjectly or worthlessly faithful to the God of reason. So in one way or another, we discovered that faith had been involved all the time.
Got me.
We found, too, that we had been worshipers. What a state of mental goose flesh that used to bring on. Had we not variously worshipped people, sentiment, things, money, and ourselves? And then, with a better motive, had we not worshipfully beheld the sunset, the sea, or a flower? Who of us had not loved something or somebody? How much did these feelings, these loves, these worships have to do with pure reason? Little or nothing, we saw at last. Were not these things the tissue out of which our lives were constructed? Did not these feelings, after all, determine the course of our existence? It was impossible to say we had no capacity for faith or love or worship. In one form or another, we had been living by faith and little else. Imagine life without faith. Were nothing left but pure reason, it wouldn't be life. But we believed in life, of course we did. We could not prove life in the sense that you can prove a straight line is the shortest distance between two points, yet there it was. Could we still say the whole thing was nothing but a mass of electrons created out of nothing, meaning nothing, whirling on to a destiny of nothingness? Of course we couldn't. The electrons themselves seemed more intelligent than that, at least so the chemist said. Hence we saw that reason isn't everything. Neither is reason, as most of us use it, entirely dependable, though it emanate or come from our best mind.
That's why it's not entirely dependable, because it comes from a human mind.
What about people who prove that man could never fly? Yet, we had been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world, people who rose above their problems. They said God made these things possible, and we only smiled. We had seen spiritual release, but liked to tell ourselves it wasn't true. Actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God.
So there's where we look for our idea of God.
It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp or self-importance, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there.
I've heard pomp described as ceremonies.
For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. We can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then, if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway.
So broad highway is capitalized. That's an interesting synonym for God. Some of our early authors, not the least of whom was Bill Wilson, were motorcycle riders. They enjoyed riding motorcycles. If you happen to be a motorcycle rider, you know exactly what they're talking about. Out on the open road, nothing in front of you but a ribbon of asphalt, wind in your face. They're trying to explain to us what a spiritual experience feels like. If you're not a motorcycle rider, talk to someone who is, and they can explain that feeling to you. And here's a promise.
Let me go back to diligently, because the definition is by steady, earnest, and energetic effort. With this attitude, you cannot fail. And that's the promise you were talking about. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. In this book, you will read the experience of a man who thought he was an atheist.
So this man is a man by the name of Fitz Mayo. His real name is John Fitzhugh Mayo. He has written a story in the back of the book entitled Our Southern Friend on page 208. And we saw Fitz earlier on page, Roman numeral page 31. That's XXI.
He was also the fifth member of AA, wasn't he?
Could be.
His story is so interesting that some of it should be told now. His change of heart was dramatic, convincing, and moving. Our friend was a minister's son. He attended church school, where he became rebellious at what he thought an overdose of religious education. For years thereafter, he was dogged by trouble and frustration. Business failure, insanity, fatal, meaning you could die from it, illness, suicide, these calamities in his immediate family embittered and depressed him. Post-war disillusionment, ever more serious alcoholism, impending mental and physical collapse brought him to the point of self-destruction. One night, when confined in a hospital, he was approached by an alcoholic who had known a spiritual experience. Our friend's gorge...
So what that means, who had a spirit... One night, when confined in a hospital, he was approached by an individual by an alcoholic who had known a spiritual experience. That means he had worked all 12 steps. Now he's coming to carry that message to Fitz.
And the gorge would be a lump in the throat, rose as he bitterly cried out, "If there is a God, he certainly hasn't done anything for me." But later, alone in his room, he asked himself this question, "Is it possible that all the religious people I have known are wrong?" While pondering the answer, he felt as though he lived in hell. Then, like a thunderbolt, a great thought came. It crowded out all else. "Who are you to say there is no God?" This man recounts that he tumbled out of bed to his knees. In a few seconds, he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God.
When we read the appendices, Spiritual Experience, they said some people drew the conclusion that the spiritual experiences must be sudden upheavals. That's because that's what they enjoy describing. And it is fun to describe those things, but not everyone has those.
Most of us have the educational variety or the spiritual awakening.
Not the least of whom is Dr. Bob Smith, our co-founder in Akron. He had a gradual educational variety spiritual awakening.
So let's go back to, in a few seconds he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God. It poured over and through him with the certainty and majesty of a great tide at flood. The barriers he had built through the years were swept away. He stood in the presence of infinite power and love. He had stepped from bridge to shore. For the first time, he lived in conscious companionship with his Creator.
So look at the synonyms for God. Presence of God, infinite power, presence of infinite power and love, Creator, those are all synonyms.
Thus was our friend's cornerstone fixed in place. No later vicissitude or change has shaken it. His alcoholic problem was taken away. That very night, years ago, it disappeared. Save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of drink has never returned. And at such times, a great revulsion has risen up in him. Seemingly, he could not drink even if he would. God had restored his sanity. What is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple.
Number one.
Circumstances made him willing to believe.
And number two.
He humbly offered himself to his Maker, then he knew. Even so, has God restored us all to our right minds. To this man, the revelation was sudden. Some of us grew into it more slowly. But he has come to all who have honestly sought him.
My conjecture is that most of us grow into it more slowly.
When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us.
We're going to move on to chapter 5. And we're going to read the first part of chapter 5. We're going to read the step 3 instructions here. Now, in how it works, we all hear that very often, many, many, many meetings throughout the United States and Canada and throughout the world begin by reading how it works. I'm going to encourage you to listen just a little bit differently to this, and we'll go ahead and examine this.
Did you want to talk about asking 5 people about...
I already did that.
Established the...
I already did that last tape, or last session, yeah.
Just, it's
Yeah, so the question, of course, would be, did you have an opportunity to talk? Did you want to talk to five people in your AA groups that you go to, how they establish their relationship with their higher power? And if you did, discuss that with your sponsor. Those are really mm-hmm. interesting conversations. Mm-hmm. So, on to Chapter 5, how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Now, there's a myth around AA, hear it all the time. Bill wanted to say never. That's not true. How do we know it's not true? Because we have a copy of a letter in our archives at our General Service office in New York, written to another AA member, where Bill says, no, I never wanted to say mm-hmm. anything other than rarely. Mm-hmm. Why people propagate those myths, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. So we may have seen a lot of people fail who have only done six steps and then stopped, mm-hmm. or eight or 11 or whatever. Mm-hmm. So they're saying, if we thoroughly follow all 12 steps of the program as laid out in the book, rarely will we see a person fail.
And in the order laid out in the book.
Right.
I kind of jumped ahead to my ninth step, but we'll get to that.
Yeah. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They're naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest.
So if we think of people who are constitutionally incapable of being honest, those are people who are just in makeup or structure, unable to be honest. And I've worked with people who actually point to that line and say, well, I must be one of those because I can't get it.
Yeah, well, the truth is that very few people fall into that category. Most are capable, may not want to, may not do it, but they're capable of doing it.
Right.
Our stories in the back of the book and how we speak at a podium in AA, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. Now, it does not say our disclose in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. It was terrible. It will continue to be terrible. I talk about what I was like. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, what does any length to get it mean? It means working all 12 steps to the best of your ability. Then you're ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked.
Hesitated.
We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil.
Zero, nothing.
Until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power, and that one is God. Here's a prayer. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. So if I do half of the steps, what do I get? Nothing.
Zero.
If I do 11, what do I get?
Nothing.
If I do 6, the same outcome. Half measures avail us nothing. We stood at the turning point. Here's another prayer. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon.
Complete abandon is to give oneself over totally.
Here are the steps we took, comma, which are suggested as a program of recovery. We talked briefly about that in session 1, I believe it was, maybe 2. But at any rate, there's a comma there. It is a thought separator. It says, here are the steps we took. They're listing the steps. And then the second thought, after the thought separator or comma, is that it's suggested as a program of recovery. There's lots of suggestions for programs. All of them have requirements inside of them. So here's the steps we took. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And as I pointed out in the last session, in the actual instructions for step 1, it says we fully conceded to our innermost self. I think that's a higher threshold, a higher bar to get over, which is why they spend so much time on it. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives, our will is our thinking and our lives are our actions, over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible. I hear it read quite often in AA meetings when people read how it works. They will read that as made direct amends to such people whenever. The word is wherever. Why is that important? Because when is a time consideration, where is a location consideration. The inference here is that we are going to do our amends face to face. So made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. We'll find in the actual instructions for step 9 that I'm not one of the others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, it is not a result. It's not a smorgasbord. It's not a buffet. We don't get to get a little dessert and maybe the meat and no vegetables. We're having one outcome and one outcome only of working the first 11 steps, and that is a spiritual awakening. It's the only result we get. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, that would be in More About Alcoholism, the chapter to the agnostics, that's we agnostics, and our personal adventures, that's the stories in the back of the book and as they're woven into the text, before and after, make clear 3 pertinent or valuable ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
And Dick stuck an extra word in there, so many do, between B and C.
Oh, yes, I did. Sorry about that. There's no and in there. There's no and in that at all. I'm a product of the same kind of sort of hearing things over and over again and assuming it's written in the book that it's not. I made a mistake there.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're reading it, especially from a podium or on a recording, we ought to leave that and out of there. So the next sentence says, being convinced. Being convinced of what? The ABCs. And I put those, when I'm working with men, into an affirmation statement, a statement of my own. And I say, I am an alcoholic and I cannot manage my own life. That's an affirmation of step 1. Transition, no human power can relieve my alcoholism. And step 2, that God can and will if I seek him. If I'm convinced of those.
Those are the prerequisites.
There you go. That's what convinced me. When we're at step 3, we're ready to move on. If I can't make that affirmation statement, there's something wrong, I got to go back and start over. Go back to tape 1, session 1.
And I do the same thing with women I'm working with, is I have them think about it, pray about it, and so when we come together before we're going to go on to the 3rd step, I want to make sure that steps 1 and 2 are solidly in place.
Being convinced of those ABCs, we were at step 3, which is that we decided, we made a decision to turn our will, that's our thinking and our life,
our actions,
over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that, and what do we do? The first requirement is, we all understand the word requirement, right? The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may be sometimes quite virtuous.
Moral, full of goodness.
He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But, as with most humans, he's more likely to have varied traits.
What usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more, meaning he's going to try even harder. He becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, and that's when you're just filled with anger about something. Self-pity.
So I'm going to now suggest that you number the following questions, and I'll call them out as Mary reads them. This is not given to us anywhere in the book that I can find, but it's a handy little helpful tool for you. And we'll talk more about these questions in another couple pages. But number one.
What is his basic trouble?
Number two.
Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind?
Number three.
Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well?
Four.
Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants?
And five.
And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate or get back at, snatching all they can get out of the show?
And six.
Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony?
So we'll be referencing those six questions in a couple of pages.
Our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. And so egocentric people are just worried about their own self, their own desires and activities. He is like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation. The minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century. Politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave. The outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him. And the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, or our self-pity? Selfishness, self-centeredness. That we think is the root of our troubles.
Wait a minute. I hear in AA all the time that this is a selfish program. Here it tells me that selfishness is the problem. Now, I know what people mean this is a selfish program. They mean that we do this work for ourselves, not for to get our job back, our wife or husband back, get the children back. That's what they mean. Why don't we say that? Say that you do this work so that for yourself so that you can get sober, not for your wife, husband, job, whatever. But when we shorthand it, it's a selfish program. Mm-hmm. We send the wrong message.
Mm-hmm. So again, we think that is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation or cause. But we invariably, always, find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt.
So highlight that last bit from the comma on, but we invariably find that sometime in the past, we've made decisions. Highlight that. We're going to need that information when we get to the fourth step.
So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything else, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid.
So must, and entirely in one paragraph. I guess there must be some musts in this book.
Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own willpower. We had to have God's help. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. That's the how. The why? It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter, in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. Notice director is capitalized. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father, and we are his children.
Director, principal, father, all capitalized.
Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom.
A keystone is the key, is the stone at the very top center of an archway made from stones, and it is cut in a certain way so that the archway doesn't collapse on us. If it's improperly cut, the archway will collapse on us.
Do we want to talk about the director here showing up?
No.
All right. I do.
Okay.
All right. So what we're trying to refer back to is, remember when the actor was trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, and the show to go his way? Well, essentially, that's God's job. God is the director. So this is how they tie that all back. When we sincerely took such a position, meaning God is our father, our director, our principal, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer.
Ooh, look, employer is capitalized. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to get a new job. That means we have a new, that's a synonym for God there.
Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing that God is the director, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn.
Now they mean reborn in a psychic sense. That word hadn't yet been become part of the lexicon in religions. So they're meaning in a psychic sense we're reborn.
So these are promises or results of actions taken. We were now at step 3. Many of us said to our Maker, as we understood him.
So here's the third step prayer in quotes here.
God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always.
So that's the prayer. Do you find it interesting, as I do, that they give us the prayer work to do and then they give us the instructions on how to do the third step after the prayer? It's pretty interesting, I think. Not seen it that way before. But here are the instructions for step 3. Number 1.
We thought well before taking this step.
And we're going to number 2.
Making sure we were ready. That we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him.
Number 3.
We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor.
So why? Well, okay, we'll keep going here.
But it's better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea.
And number 4.
Voicing it without reservation.
So to voice something means we say it out loud. Now, why would they tell us to take this third step with our best friend or spiritual advisor or even our spouse or some understanding person, when in fact they all did this third step with their sponsors? And I think we've talked about this before, but in case we hadn't, there were 100 AA members in the entire universe, and they printed 5,000 copies of the book. They believed this book was going to go out to thousands and thousands of people. And they didn't want to tell them to do something with their sponsor if they were the only person in that community that had this. So they give us all kinds of... As a matter of fact, today in most communities in the U.S. and Canada, there's lots of understanding people inside of AA. Their nickname is sponsor. So we can do this. So our first one is going to be to think... Our first instruction is to think well. You tell me to think well when I'm new in sobriety... And to go off and just think, the committee starts working up in the head, and I start getting all kinds of cockamamie ideas. So you remember the 6 questions that we talked about back on page 61? Take out a yellow sheet of paper. Again, I can't prove that they ever did this, but it's a useful tool. Take out a tablet of paper and write down the answers to all 6 of those questions as best you can, as much writing as you want to do. We're going to think well before taking this step. Why? Because we're going to, number 2, make sure that we're ready, that we can at last abandon ourselves utterly to God. Number 3, we're going to do this with someone. I see new people in AA, and I say, have a conversation, and they'll say, I'm getting ready to do step 3, and I say, oh, who are you going to do it with? And they look at me like I dropped in from Mars. they don't understand that the instructions are very clear here, that we do. It's very desirable to do this with a sponsor or an understanding person. We don't do this in a vacuum. And number four, we're going to say it out loud. We're going to do the third step prayer or some semblance of it out loud.
When I work with somebody, I ask them to prepare, and then it tells us the wording can be optional. So if you look at the way the prayer is written, it's using some of the King James Bible language, and I ask them if they'd like to change the words to you or something more current, or just have a free form type of prayer as long as they can express these ideas and are ready to move on to what we're going to learn about in the next paragraph, which is the house cleaning. So next.
So this is all part of the third step instructions here.
Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision
step three
was a vital and crucial step, it could have little or permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face
4 and 5
and to be rid of
6, 7, 8, and 9
the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions.
So that will be the end of this session, because we want to save an entire session for step four. So we're only an hour in, but we'll go ahead and stop here. And we'll look forward to you on the backside when we talk about step 4 and 5. Thank you.